Dear God, we just want to ask your presence to be here today. Just be with me. This is your message, and it's powerful, and it's compelling, and it's clear, but I may not be able to present it that way on my own. So I ask that you would just speak through me and give everybody attentive and clear minds that we could understand, and that we would be motivated for the mission that you have for each of our lives. In your name I pray, amen. Okay, the message I have today is called Rediscovering Our Roots, Motivated for Mission. When we talk about our roots, I wanted to ask a question first. What Bible verse do you think was the impetus behind the Millerite movement that, of course, grew into Adventism? If you were to pick one verse, what verse would you pick? Okay, I think I'm hearing mostly a consensus. Daniel 8:14, right? Here's a little bit more subjective one. If you think of one verse today, if you think of Adventism and you think of one verse that might encapsulate or represent Adventism, what verse would you pick? What was yours, Reed?
Revelation 10.
What, you thinking of a specific verse in there? Okay, Revelation 10:11, I think it is. Prophesy again, that's a good one. Anybody else? I heard Revelation 14, 6 through 8, so first angel's message. Okay, yep. Any others? Yeah. Hebrews 8:1. What does that one say? Okay, so talking about the high priest, sure. Okay, so what I wanted to point out is if we think about how we started as a movement and we think about our movement today, the critical verses that first come to mind probably come from Daniel and Revelation, right? So if we're talking about our roots, those are the two books that I'm going to suggest that we look at today, and that's what we're going to go over. Thanks for working on this, guys. So the title again is Rediscovering Our Roots. And then our objective is to be motivated for mission. So here's kind of an agenda for today. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the purpose of prophecy, and we're going to use that then as a framework to look at Daniel and Revelation. Of course, it's going to be a high-level view, right? There's so much you could go into, but it's going to be high-level. And I've heard it said, you know, that Daniel is kind of algebra to prepare you for the calculus of Revelation. You know, I would say the sanctuary is maybe like basic math. You know, if you don't have a foundation in the sanctuary, you're going to end up kind of lost in both books. So we're not going to look at the sanctuary today. That's kind of prerequisite. So if you haven't refreshed on that in a while or studied that, you know, go through the last part of Exodus and Leviticus. That's going to be the groundwork that you're going to need. So we're going to look at the major time prophecies that are introduced in Daniel and expounded on in Revelation, and then a two-minute drill. So if you're talking to somebody that, you know, maybe familiar with the Bible but not super familiar with Daniel and Revelation in particular, you can't sit down and, you know, bring out all these charts like, you know, these sloppy ones that I drew on the board, right? You just have a minute or two. What are you going to tell them about Daniel and Revelation? So we're going to try to do that. And then how does this all tie together, and how does it drive our mission? Okay, so the purpose of prophecy. I'm curious, were any of you here, and do you remember a guy from Michigan named Aaron Cruz that spoke here about 2 years ago? Anybody remember that message? I see a few. Okay. So I really liked his message was called this title that you see, Purpose of Prophecy. And he used three C's is how he described it. And we're going to kind of use that framework as we go through today. So the purpose of prophecy. The first thing is prophecy gives us confidence. When people see, you know, when they look, they're introduced to, you know, the image in Daniel, let's say, it's not just that they're seeing, you know, an image and nations and things like that. You know, they start to see when they see that history has followed just as predicted. You know, something starts to change inside of them, right? They start to more think about, you know, if God knows the future before it happens, what else does he know? You know, he probably knows what I'm going through and what I'm thinking, right? So it gives people confidence in God's divinity and in the truthfulness of the Bible. Okay. It provides context. It shows the time that we're living in terms of earthly history as well as spiritual history. And then finally, Christ. So we're going to spend a little bit more time on this one just to develop it a little bit. But really, prophecy is calculated. I mean, it's specifically to introduce people to Christ, and not just introduce, but those of us that already have been introduced to him, to increase our love for him as we learn more about him and what his plans for the future are. So once we understand, we call these the three C's of the purpose of prophecy. Once we understand these three C's, I think it'll really motivate us to complete the mission that we have as Seventh-day Adventists. Okay, so like I said, we'll talk about the purpose of prophecy and how it relates to Christ just a little bit to set this up. In Daniel says in chapter 2, "But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but that you may know the thoughts of your heart." Okay, so this is, of course, talking to Nebuchadnezzar. It says that you may know the thoughts of your heart. Well, what was Jesus' purpose? If you look in Luke 2, it says, "Then Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, Jesus' mother, 'Behold, this child is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and for a sign which will be spoken against, that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed.'" Interesting, huh? The purpose of Nebuchadnezzar, the dream that he had, and that prophecy, and the purpose of Jesus looks pretty similar, doesn't it? It's to reveal the thoughts of our hearts. And so, you know, I think there's a sentiment, you know, I don't have any quantitative data on this or anything, but people kind of, I hear criticisms of, you know, why does the Adventist Church do these prophecy seminars? Shouldn't we, instead of scaring people with beasts and images, you know, shouldn't we maybe just tell them about Jesus first, tell them about Christ? You know, but I think rightly understood, the purpose of prophecy and the purpose of Christ are ultimately one and the same. You know, the purpose of both is to shine light and really into our hearts, which without that light are completely dark. Okay, a couple more about Christ. Ellen White says, "The truth for this time is broad in its outlines, far-reaching, embracing many doctrines, but these doctrines are not detached items. They are united by golden threads, forming a complete whole, and notice this, with Christ as the living center." So the truth for this time certainly includes prophecy, right? I mean, you might even say it's specifically prophecy. And Christ is the living center of this. And then 2 Peter 1:19 is, I think, probably the most straightforward passage about this topic. It says, "And so we have," what kind of word? Prophetic word. "We have the prophetic word confirmed, which you do well to heed as a light that shines in a dark place, until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts." And the morning star there, of course, is Jesus, right? So, again, the purpose of the prophetic word is to have the morning star, the light of Jesus, rise in our hearts. Okay, one more statement from Ellen White, Testimonies to Ministers and Gospel Workers. She says, "When the books of Daniel and Revelation are better understood, believers will have an entirely different religious experience. They will be given such glimpses of the open gates of heaven that heart and mind will be impressed with a character that all must develop in order to realize the blessedness, which is to be the reward of the pure in heart." Powerful statement. All right, so first, let's talk about Daniel a little bit using our context of the three C's, or a framework of the three C's. Confidence. How does Daniel give us confidence? Well, it shows that God knows and controls the future, right? He predicted it accurately thousands of years before it happened. Okay. Context. Daniel, we're going to look at this a little bit more, but Daniel repeatedly focuses on the end of time or the last days, and it shows us that we're living in that time right now. And Christ, there's many, many things here that we could glean out of Daniel, but here's a few. And this helps if you understand the sanctuary first, but judgment is going to be rendered in favor of the saints. Christ is going to come to earth, which was a future event when Daniel was written, to make reconciliation for us, and that he's ultimately going to defeat sin. Okay, so we have, you can see, I put on the board here a couple of charts, which hopefully you have in with handouts in your bulletins as well, the same thing, except for they're nice and square in your bulletins and they're not up here. Okay, so let's go we'll go through this first. So the empires prophesied in Daniel, we can run through them, right? Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and Rome has its two phases, right? That's important. Pagan phase and papal phase. And then we have Rome divided or divided Europe, however you want to describe it. And then there's actually four visions in Daniel that go through this same sequence, but the three main ones I've put here. Let's talk a little bit about those. Why do you think the bear is raised up on one side and the ram has two horns? What's the parallel there? What are we seeing? Okay, Medo-Persia, right? A two-part empire. Also to note there, the bear is raised up higher on one side and one horn is higher than the other, right? So just like Reed put Persia, that turned out to be the dominant empire. It was Medo-Persia, but the first king was from Media, but all the kings after that were from Persia. So there's some important, and even the chest and arms of silver, you know, give two arms. You get the idea of a divided kingdom. Okay, Greece. Why does the leopard have four heads? Greece was divided four ways, four generals. Yep, absolutely. And why do you think if we look at chapter 8, why do you think the first box is blank? Why don't we see Babylon up there in chapter 8? I'm hearing it already passed. I'm looking for something a little different because it didn't actually already pass. It was still around for about 12 more years. Anything else? Read. Yes, exactly. So that's our first, and it makes sense, right? Logically, we would think, well, this is getting towards the end of Babylon. Maybe they're kind of off the scene, but that's actually not the case. So if you look at chapter 8, it's very important because chapter 8 is all about cleansing the sanctuary. And it's even down to the detail that it starts not with Babylon, even though Babylon was still reigning then. It starts with Medo-Persia because that's where our 2,300 days over here, if we come over here, in 457 BC, this falls in the kingdom of Medo-Persia. Reed already kind of hit on this, but why do you think it's that the animals that are used in chapter 8 are a ram and a goat? Is there any significance there? Sacrificial animals, sanctuary animals, right? Absolutely. So chapter 8 is clearly just keeps reinforcing this point. We're talking about the sanctuary. Here's the sanctuary animals. We're talking about the 2,300 days. That's where Daniel 8:14 is, the cleansing of the sanctuary. It all starts in Medo-Persia over here. Okay. Good job. Thanks, Reed, for doing that. I know that was a lot of blanks. I did also want to point out, people have questioned. I've heard skeptics say, you know, maybe Daniel is kind of added later in the Bible after these empires all came into view and they kind of snuck it in there, right? But in 1947, the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, and that pretty much put that to bed. I mean, with several different dating methods, we can tell that this book was existing at least a couple hundred, few hundred years before Christ. So these prophecies were written when, you know, before the nations came to power. Okay, so one thing that people wonder about a lot is the little horn. You know, what is this little horn power? Well, being a horn myself, I have some knowledge about that. So I thought I would share with you guys what I know about that. So this is how it works. So this is the horn family. And as you can see, Daniel 8:9 clearly says, out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great. So this is the one here that the little horn came from. And he showed up on September 13th. He showed up. And you can see he's starting to grow exceedingly great. So that's him. So if anyone tries to tell you something differently about the little horn, don't listen to them. Okay, let's look at Mackenzie's work a little bit here. Everybody that I saw already gave a thumbs up, so it looked pretty good. And let's talk about this time prophecy. So Daniel introduces us to three key time prophecies and a fundamental date that you need to remember, because it actually starts the 70 weeks and the 2300 days, is this 457 BC, the date over here. And that was the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. It's an important date because, I mean, we don't get to 1844 without starting in that date, right? It's a very important date. Also starts with 70 weeks, but it's also a very well-established date because we have extra biblical sources we can track down and see. You know, Ezra tells us the certain year of Artaxerxes' reign where this occurred, and we have, I think it's called the Scroll of Ptolemy, but it's an extra biblical source that, you know, we can track what year this actually happened in. So we have great support for that 457 BC. And once you have that as your linchpin, the rest of it falls into place. So we go through the 70 weeks prophecy, right? And most of the action in the 70 weeks happens in the last week. So if you look at 27 AD, so it comes out to 490 years, right, prophetically. And the last 7 years, or the last week, is where most of it takes place. So this is about, you know, Jesus coming. He starts his ministry when he's baptized here. 27 AD, 31 AD, the middle of the week, he's cut off, right? Does that sound familiar? The middle of the week, he's cut off. So that brings us into the spring of 31 AD when Jesus died. And then finally, in 34 AD, Stephen was stoned. And that brought an end to the probationary time period for the Israelites, where Jesus said, you know, not individual Jews, but as a people, you guys have rejected. I've been patient. I've been forbearing with you guys. I've given you prophets after prophet. I came myself. Now, even 3.5 years later after that, you still haven't gotten it. You've stoned another prophet. Your time as my chosen nation is done, right? And that's, if you remember when Peter asked Jesus, right, how many times should I forgive somebody? He says 70 times 7, which is 490. It's this right here. It's how many times, how long Jesus forgave Israel, 490 years. Okay. You continue on the 2300 days, then we have the 1260-day time period, which goes from 538 A.D., until 1798 AD. And this is the time period of papal dominance. You might hear it also explained as a time, times, and a dividing of time, time, times, and half a time. You do the math on it. This is actually, I think, seven times between Daniel and Revelation. It's mentioned, it's called 42 months. But it all gives us the same time period. And this is the time period where the papacy had authority to rule over church and state. 533, just a few years before 538, Justinian, the emperor, had basically declared the pope to be the head of all churches. He wanted to invest him with this supreme authority. And in 538, that was kind of able to be implemented as the papacy was able to gain a victory over the Ostrogoths and become a dominant religious and political power. Okay. So we get to 1798, and that power is finally broken. The pope is captured. He is taken into captivity. And at that's by the French, by the way. And at that time, the papacy no longer is able to control the state. They don't have civil authority. We know that deadly wound is going to be healed, though. But for now, it's in the process of being healed. And the 2300 days ends in 1844, which is where we see the judgment beginning in heaven. Okay. I know that was a lot, so thanks for bearing with me there. Okay, so Daniel. We already talked about how it gives us confidence. It gives us context. Daniel highlights the time of the end. There's four visions in Daniel, four prophetic visions. They each run through the same sequence of kingdoms, and they use this principle called repeat and enlarge. So each vision gives us some more details, more information. But what I want to focus on is if you look at the end of each vision. So chapter 2 ends, the rock smashes the image, and it's the second coming, right? Chapter 7 and 8 end in a judgment time period in heaven. So the cleansing of the sanctuary and the judgment in heaven, which we just reviewed, starts in 1844. And then chapter 11, the final prophetic section in Daniel, ends again with the second coming, okay? So you have this theme. Daniel keeps pointing out, hey, this is all building up earthly history. All these kingdoms are coming and going. but hey, it's all going to end between, we're going to focus on the time of the judgment. Daniel basically calls this the time of the end until the second coming. So that's the time period that Daniel's highlighting. It's a judgment time period, and we see that theme in Daniel of judgment, and that's where we find ourselves living right now. Okay, so let's try to do Daniel in 2 minutes now. This will be my attempt at it. So key theme in Daniel you have to understand is a judgment theme. The name Daniel means God is my judge. So right off the bat, we have a clue about that. The first 6 chapters of Daniel, we could say the first half, because it's basically 2 books put into one. We find the story of 4 captive Israelites that are faithful to God in all circumstances, no matter how difficult, right? We have chapter 1, Daniel's faithful in diet. And then in chapter 3, Daniel's friends are faithful in worship. In chapter 6, Daniel himself is faithful in worship. And they're living in a judgment time period themselves, right? They understand, they're demonstrating, hey, I understand God is my judge. There's this other foreign nation that's trying to put all these laws on me, but actually God is my judge and I'm going to follow him no matter what. So they give us lessons for how we can live now that we see prophetically we're living in a judgment time period as well. So you get to the second half of Daniel and there's 4 prophetic visions that reveal the future. It may seem like kingdoms and earth's history are coming and going in a random sequence, whoever happens to be stronger. But actually, we see that God knew how it was all going to happen. His hand is in all of it. Each of the 4 visions points to a time of judgment at the end of earth's history. And then Daniel, along with Revelation, show that we're in that time period today. And then finally, the point you have to see is that God's victorious. His kingdom will conquer and last forever. And we're all invited to be part of it, right? Okay, so there's Daniel. What do we have next? Revelation. All right. So here's a little bit of a visual that I kind of put together. There's some different ways you can kind of try to break down Revelation, but if you look at it, the first roughly 12 chapters are mostly dealing with historical events. This is stuff that's already happened. Okay, we can look back at it. It wasn't all historical to John when he wrote it, but it is now. Chapter 13 on is mostly dealing with eschatological or prophetic events, stuff that we expect to happen at the end of time, stuff that's prophesied. Similarly, you can view it chapters 1 through 14, you see all these conflicts going on, these struggles. You know, some good things happen for God's people and then some bad things happen. Some good things happen, some bad things. So it's this struggle going on, which, you know, we kind of know is the great controversy. But then in chapters 15 on, it's really only positive things for God's people. It's all about victory. And so we get this picture that, you know, there's going to be struggles, but ultimately it's going to turn out all right for God's people. Then some of the main themes, you have, of course, a lot of sevens in Revelation. The number 7 representing the complete history of the church, 7 being a number of completion. So you have the history of the church kind of looked at from some different angles. You have the 7 churches, the 7 seals, the 7 trumpets. Then in chapters 12 through 14, it's kind of a behind-the-scenes look at the controversy that's been going on between Christ and Satan. Okay? You have, in the last part of Revelation, plagues, Babylon being destroyed in the second coming, and then the grand climax, final judgment, and Eden is restored. Okay, so these are some of the things that we talked about here. I did want to point out this is one way to think about the series of sevens that we have in the first half of Revelation. The 7 churches are basically a relationship between God and his church, his people. The 7 seals are a relationship between his people and the world, the church and the world. And then the 7 trumpets are where God responds to those seals because the relationship between the church and the world has been pretty brutal a lot of times. A lot of killing going on, and God responds in the trumpets and says, hey, I have some judgments that are going to be poured out on the church's enemies. Okay, and then the great controversy summary, like I talked about, the conflict between Christ and Satan is in those middle chapters in Revelation. The second section, which is all positive for God's people, we see the destruction of the wicked, and we see Eden being restored. Okay, so applying these same three C's to Revelation, confidence, context, and Christ. Here's some thoughts that I had about that. Revelation gives us confidence because most of it's already been fulfilled. You know, if we look at, from John's perspective, it was all future, but we can look back now and see historical fulfillment in most of the book. And actually, specifically, we've already seen six churches fulfilled. We're living in the seventh church. You get to the seals, we're kind of at the end of the sixth seal. So we've seen 5.5 seals fulfilled or more. And we've seen six trumpets fulfilled as well. So if you look at the church history in those contexts, it's all pointing us that, you know, we're at the end. Okay? Revelation gives us context. It shows us we're in the last days. Again, we're in the seventh church of Revelation, the sixth seal, and the seventh trumpet. Also, the seventh church, if you remember, because you probably have, because it's our church, right? We're called the Church of Laodicea. Does anybody know what the name Laodicea means?
Lukewarm.
That's a description of Laodicea, but it's not what it means.
A people judged?
Yeah, a judged people, right? So even the name Laodicea gives us the idea, again, just like we saw in Daniel, we're living in a judgment time period, okay? And Christ, there's so much that you see with Christ, which is beautiful when you tie the sanctuary into it as well and see what Christ has been doing on our behalf. But Revelation shows us that throughout the church's history, Jesus, what he's been doing is working for our salvation tirelessly. And we also see that he's ultimately going to be victorious in this great controversy battle with Satan. Okay, so Revelation in 2 minutes. What could we say about Revelation? First of all, Revelation, it's the revelation of Jesus Christ, right? That's what it all comes down to. We're told this right at the beginning, but a lot of times we forget. We get lost in the symbols. People give up, say it can't be understood. But it's the revelation of Jesus Christ. Reveals his work on our behalf, working for our salvation all the way until the second coming. Okay, so there's a problem introduced early in Revelation. When you get to the last church in Laodicea, the problem is the church is in a bad state. It's supposed to be this judgment hour church, but it's lukewarm, like Zoltan already pointed out, right? It's lukewarm. There's a bad problem. You could even say it's the worst of the seven churches. So you move on. You get to the end of the seven seals. God shows what he's going to do about it. He says, there's this problem, but I have an answer for that. I'm going to raise up a faithful remnant people. Even though things are really bad, out of this last church, there's going to be a group that is faithful to me. You move on. You get to the end of the seven trumpets, and God reveals which movement that's going to be. Chapter 10, he says, this is going to be the second Advent movement. He goes on. You get to chapter 14, and he says specifically how he is going to accomplish this. He's going to do it with the three angels' messages. And there's going to be a proclamation of the everlasting gospel, the true gospel, in the context of the three angels' messages. So then in conclusion, we see that those that allow Christ to change their character are redeemed. And we go all the way back to Genesis and we remember Eden being lost, right? In the very beginning of the Bible, we come all the way to the end and we see finally that Eden's been restored in Revelation. Okay, so in summary, Daniel and Revelation, again, with this framework, confidence. God knows and controls the future, right? We can trust his word. We can trust him. His timing is perfect. He even dated, just like on this chart here, he even dated key spiritual events in advance for us. Nations rise and fall, but God's kingdom lasts forever. Context. We're living in earth's last days. Daniel especially, Daniel and Revelation both repeatedly point that out to us. 1844 until the second coming is specifically highlighted as the most important period in Earth's history. And the reason I say that, not to downplay the cross, that was the single most important event, but I say time period because it's when the great controversy comes to a head. Satan says, you know, humans have been getting worse and worse and worse. God, you don't have anyone that can keep your law. And God says, out of this church, even the last church, Laodicea, I have a people that's going to be faithful, and now I am victorious in the great controversy. Satan, you don't have anything else to say. And Christ shows Jesus working on our behalf for our salvation throughout history. It shows that Christ is our advocate in the judgment, and the judgment is actually going to be in our favor. So as long as we have a relationship with Christ, the judgment's actually a good thing. And then it shows Christ's unwavering purpose, which is to be with us for eternity. Okay, so in closing, studying prophecy leads us to have confidence in God's word, understand the spiritual context of the times that we're living in, and to know Christ on a personal level as we see his labor of love for us in the past and what his plans are, which are to give us eternal life. So I think once we see these three things, confidence, context, and Christ, when we're using that framework to look at prophecy, I think for myself, and I pray for everybody, the result is that we're going to be motivated for mission. And we know that we have a specific mission as Christians and as Seventh-day Adventists, right? And the mission is introduced pretty simply here in Matthew, right? Go ye therefore and make disciples of all nations. So how do we do this? It's kind of what I want to leave you with. I think we do it by rediscovering our roots. We started in the books of Daniel and Revelation, and I think we need to look back there again, because in so doing, what we're really doing is looking back at Christ that started this whole movement in the first place. And I think that we must prophesy again.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.